Just a reminder, the content of this show is for informational purposes only. Please visit blockstack.org/legal/disclaimers for more info. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Stacks Podcast. I'm Zach Valenti. Today's episode features an interview between Meltem Demirs, cryptocurrency investor, advisor, advocate, and chief strategy officer of the digital asset management firm CoinShares, and Patrick Stanley, head of growth at Blockstack PBC. The two discuss all things staking and governance. They talk about various protocols implementing staking, relate contemporary crypto networks back to classical Greek philosophy, explore the future or lack of one of VC in light of recent crypto developments, and more. And now, without further ado, here's Meltem and Patrick.
Welcome, Meltem, to the podcast. Thanks for joining.
Hey, Patrick. Great to be here.
We're going to talk about staking today. This is something that you kind of put on conferences. You're very much involved in staking as a general thing. And I wanted to ask you to kind of give a couple minute overview on what staking is and why it's becoming such a topic of conversation lately.
Sure. I would say I am just generally a person who is interested in all things crypto. And one of the interesting new evolutions we've seen, when I started in the crypto world, it was just Bitcoin. And Bitcoin's all about proof of work. My firm, CoinShares, has done a lot of research around Bitcoin mining, which is where and how proof of work gets done. And it's really all about, building a secure, resilient computational network to secure the value of Bitcoin. And you can find that research on the CoinShares site. My colleague, Chris Ben Dixon, who's our head of research, has done a lot of great analysis around the CapEx or the capital expenditure and the OpEx or the operational expenditure that goes into it. And as we've experienced over the last 3 years with the Bitcoin block size wars, forking of Bitcoin into sub-communities and sub-chains that had differing sort of perspectives on what should be implemented at the protocol level, we have had a lot of conversation, with the launch of Ethereum around this hypothetical thing called proof of stake. It's a new way for nodes in a network to achieve consensus, and they do it through an act called staking. Now, it's difficult to summarize staking in an effective way because each proof of stake protocol implements its staking mechanism differently. And so I don't want to generalize, but really staking is all about the act of securing the network in a new way. And there is a new twist on many of these protocols that are deploying proof of stake, in that staking is not only used as a function to secure and maintain and operate the network, meaning how do you run the protocol or the code in physical space? Well, you have to use computational capacity and electricity, so there is cost there. And then the second component that we're seeing for the first time, which I think is fascinating in many different regards, is the emergence of a formal on-chain governance process. And so the idea is, instead of this perceived tyranny we have in Bitcoin or the chaos we've had in protocols that maybe don't have a formalized governance process, we are now experimenting with new forms of governance, which really is just decision-making about what happens next, utilizing staking and people's ownership of tokens in a network, their ability to provide computational resources to the network as a way for them to participate in formal decision making, much like the informal Ethereum coin vote that happened in 2017 when the hard fork was being explored. So hopefully that is a brief enough synopsis. I know there's a lot packed in there.
Yeah, for sure. What are kind of the benefits for stakers in various ecosystems? What can they be?
Sure. I think a lot of the conversation about staking right now is bifurcated into two camps. Number one, there is this growing sort of narrative, which I would very much like to dispel, that staking is about earning yield. It's not yield. It's not interest. This is not debt. You are not taking collateral risk in staking. You are not attempting to do a risk-reward trade-off. In the staking model, you are earning inflation. And so by participating in staking, people are preserving their pro rata share of ownership of tokens in the network. So here's a really simple example. Say, for example, the network I'm most familiar with is Tezos. Say that you own 1 million Tezos and there are 100 million Tezos overall. And every year, 5% of new supply comes online in the form of staking rewards. This is a reward that goes to people to compensate them for the cost and the sort of resource expenditure of participating in the network by running these nodes. And so if you own 1 million Tezos, which are the tokens in this protocol, and you do not participate in staking, you lose your pro rata share of the network. If you want to maintain your share of the network, you have to participate in the network. And in fact, some networks now are introducing negative rewards, like Augur, which is going to be the first to introduce slashing, which is where you actually lose coins if you're not participating in staking or governance. And so to me, this whole idea of like, oh, earn yield is a bit of a misnomer. You're earning an inflationary reward. And so a lot of investors are interested in this inflationary reward. And economically speaking, there is a lot of debate as to whether owning more of an inflationary supply of an asset actually makes you economically better off. Theoretically, if you run the math, you're actually losing value, but we can get into that. And then I think the second sort of interest in staking that in my view is far more interesting and it's far more thorny and nuanced is the political mechanism that we use to make decisions about protocols. And so I think there is a lot of conversation now. There are new staking as a service provider companies emerging. Also, natural places where coins get aggregated, such as wallets, exchanges, custodial services, are now having to stake on behalf of their clients because they are fiduciaries. And so the question becomes, well, how do you decide in a particular governance decision what decision to make on behalf of your stakeholders? So there is this really interesting governance aspect to staking as well. And some of the early experiments with MakerDAO and Aragon in particular have given us some interesting results where we see that much like the existing political process we have in the US and other places in our world where we have either representative or direct pardon democracies, the turnout rates for many of these governance decisions in these protocols are quite low. And given the fact that there are going to be so many protocols who have a staking mechanism, we only have limited bandwidth. I mean, I feel like I try to read and absorb as much as I can, but even I, to be totally candid, I'm not aware of all of the governance implications of these decisions that are being made. It's rapidly becoming a very interesting sort of political conversation and prompting discussions around what good governance actually looks like, which, by the way, that's a 3,000-year-old problem. That's not
totally a good problem. Totally. I mean, like, in doing research into things like staking and governance, you end up having to go back to the ancient Greeks and beyond in order to see why they chose things like randomness in selecting juries and things like that. And so, I think governance is definitely a thorny kind of thing, and it's not totally clear. There's like a cut and dry, you know, final kind of version of how governance should be done on a crypto network. But you mentioned the low turnout for voters.
Hold on, Patrick, wait, before we go into that, I do want to say, even though we may not know the optimal sort of way to run governance, we do know things that don't work well. So what I go back to and what I've written about, you can find it on my Medium. I wrote this post called Power, Politics, and Protocols. There is this great Greek, I guess, philosopher, if you'll call him that, named Polybius. And he wrote about this thing called the social political cycle, also named the Kyklos cycle. And he had some really prescient observations, you know, 3,000 years ago about how different forms of human organization might be structured. And some of the key takeaways he had, I just want to highlight three of them because I think they're really relevant to how people are structuring the relationship between protocols, foundations, governance mechanisms in these networks, token holders. The first is that no ruler should be a ruler indefinitely. So you should prevent tyranny by having mechanisms that enable succession. And I think, you know, you've probably thought about this with how Blockstack has gone from being one team to now several different entities that play different roles in the Blockstack ecosystem. There's a lot to think about there. The second aspect that I thought was really important is that people should not be compensated for participating in governance. And I thought that's really interesting because effectively what we're doing with staking is trying to use a financial incentive or an incentive in the form of token inflation to incentivize people to participate. And what that results in is people engaging in proxy voting. And as we've seen in the last 100 years of corporate governance, people don't participate in proxy votes. You get your little Charles Schwab or Vanguard mailings that ask you to proxy vote for the companies in which you're a shareholder, and you just recycle it.
Totally. Yeah, you're quoted saying you cannot pay people exorbitant amounts to govern. Is it that they're making governance decisions in Tezos or not? I'm trying to draw a distinction here.
Yes. And so here again is the challenge in the fact that each protocol does this very differently. And so we have, you know, as many protocols as there are that many different nuanced governance systems. So in Tezos, decisions that are made about protocol upgrades, so technical specifications and changes to the protocol itself, are done by people who stake and provide computational resources to the network. That function of securing the network and providing governance to the network are one and the same. Now, in Decred, which is a different protocol, these two functions are separated. There is one staking mechanism that is utilized to make changes to the protocol, and there is a second and separate entity called Politeia that is used to vote on how the decentralized treasury of Decred will be used, meaning how will the community, quote unquote, spend the resources it has at its disposal to conduct experiments, to compensate people for services, et cetera. And so I think, again, these fundamental differences in how people are structuring these relationships between different entities is interesting. There's a lot of experimentation. But I think, you know, I always go back to this: history doesn't repeat, but it certainly rhymes. And I think many of us would be well served to go back and look at how governance has worked historically and what has and has not worked well, and to use some of those learnings to design better experiments.
Absolutely. Thanks for letting me interject on that second one. You had a third point from Polybius.
Oh, the third is this, sorry. And no worries, please interject. I don't think conversations should be linear. That's very boring. The third point was this: it's that you cannot have good governance unless the populace knows what good governance is. And this is kind of a strange one, but the real idea here is that the populace must be educated about governance in order to understand how to effectively participate. And so in those days, the way that was done was through places like the forum, where people would go and you had professional orators. You had people who engaged in satire and other types of performance that were intended to be commentary to inform people's opinions on various governance decisions. So even though you had this formal governance body, the Senate, you also had senators, orators, and other people who were informing the population as to what was going on and providing an active discussion forum or place for dialogue, debate, discovery of these issues. I think one of the big challenges for crypto is right now our communication forum is Twitter, but Twitter is very ephemeral. And then each community has kind of its own many sub-communication platforms. And so the challenge is, if you are a quote-unquote digital citizen in one of these protocols, where are you going to go to be informed as to all of the myriad of decisions that are being made? And where are you going to go to educate yourself about these decisions? I think that's a really interesting sort of UX social coordination challenge. And so it's just interesting.
Yeah, the UX question is interesting. You're seeing custody providers enter the game, like Coinbase and Staked.us and others. We'd love to kind of hear some of your thoughts on general UX and maybe potential pitfalls from this kind of like forced arrangement in some cases when it comes to projects that, you know, require custody in order to do staking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think the first is this. There is this active conversation underway about the role that fiduciaries play in crypto networks. And so here's sort of my example, and it's a little bit of a dramatic one, but I think it's helpful because it's illustrative. So with some of the research we've done at CoinShares, again, indicates that 25% of all Bitcoin in circulation, meaning Bitcoin that hasn't been lost, 25% of it fully is held by third parties, if not more. Wow. And so, you know, that's a good data point. If we look at newer coins like Tezos or others. I don't have exact numbers, but let's say for the sake of this argument that 33% or fully one third of all the tokens are held by other custodial services. So they are not directly in control of users.
Sure.
Now in finance, there are a series of laws that have been passed over the last 100 years that separate different parts of a bank or a financial institution. And there are very specific rules about how fiduciaries, i.e. people who hold stocks for people, participate in corporate governance on behalf of those beneficial owners, right? A lot of this has been explored by Ronald Coase, Jensen and Meckling in the theory of the firm and behavioral economics. And it continues to be an area of inquiry that is very interesting to economists, mathematicians, psychologists, sociologists alike. And so say, for example, that you have a new protocol. People don't know how to vote or stake in the protocol, so people rely on a third-party custodian. And now there are decisions happening around governance, around changes to the protocol that impact the politics of the protocol, that impact the balance of power, that impact the potential future of this network. Now, these people who own these tokens theoretically are the ones who should be making decisions. But because of the design of some of these protocols, they are not being served the ability to make those decisions themselves. And so the question becomes, if you are a custodian, if you are a staking as a service provider, do you also then become a proxy voter? And then in fact, could that lead to the emergence of large centralized stakeholder cartels that are incentivized to collude with other large state cartels? And this behavior, by the way, has been widely reported on in EOS, where people vote for block producers. I will direct people, you know, just Google EOS block producer cartel. There have been some interesting allegations there about how exchanges are using the EOS they have in their wallets to vote in or vote out certain block producers. And so it just starts to create fundamental conflicts of interest that, again, go against the spirit of some of the ways that financial law has evolved over the last 100 years to create a very delineating line between principals and agents or shareholders and executives of these firms. And so, again, a lot of analogs there, in my view, about potentially how crypto land might evolve. But again, I don't think we can design effective governance mechanisms without being very aware of some of the very real issues that emerge when you insert a fiduciary in the middle of that process.
For sure. Very well explained and appreciate that. There was something I was reading in an article on Decrypt Media that came out featuring you a few days ago. And you said people are starting to form alliances across different protocols. You're starting to see a lot more formalization now that people realize there's so much money there. These protocols don't really operate in a vacuum when it comes to things like bribery, collusion, alliances, things like that. And I was wondering if you could unpack kind of that quote for the listeners.
Sure. Look, at the end of the day, I think humans we're interesting creatures. We're very social, we're political, we're tribal. And if you just look at what's happened, for example, in the Bitcoin community over the last 5 years, you look at what the Ethereum community is going through right now, it's sort of an ideological shift. There's a bit of a splintering with people dividing into different camps, different systems of belief, different perspectives on what the future should look like. And so I think what we're starting to see is, there's so many different protocols, there's so many different rules, there's so many different players, there's so many different stakeholders. Starting to untangle all of that, you very quickly realize that even being involved in one protocol is a full-time activity. And so I think what people are starting to recognize is partnering with people who share similar objectives, similar perspectives, similar goals for a protocol might be an effective way to create off-chain social coordination. And look, calling it a cartel is a bit incendiary because the word cartel inherently implies some sort of socially negative behavior. But in fact, economically speaking, a cartel isn't necessarily negative. Cartels have been historically to coordinate around markets, right? And so if you think about OPEC, I think OPEC is a great example. OPEC is a cartel, and OPEC is formed by the countries in the world who sit on the largest reserves of oil. So effectively, the people who control all of the oil on our planet have banded together to form a cartel to effectively set the price per barrel of oil. theoretically, you could very quickly see, especially given the choices that protocols have made in how to sell or distribute the resources in their protocol. If you sell 80% of the tokens in your network to large funds who are fiduciaries and focused on optimizing profit, even though, you know, a lot of, I don't think investors are bad people. I think many of them ideologically share the same objectives as the projects they're investing in. But it's important to remember an investor is a fiduciary. It is their job to make money. And so they will make decisions at the end of the day that are the best for them as a fiduciary, not as a supporter of a project. Mm-hmm. And so I think, again, just thinking about the OPEC example, right? If you have, you know, 10 firms and they together control 60% of the economic interest in a protocol or the supply of tokens in a protocol, and their ownership of that protocol is reinforced over time through this inflationary mechanism, meaning they do not get diluted down over time. Right. And their vote is also proportional to their stake.
Yeah.
Then you could very quickly see that that becomes a cartel. Now, I am not by any means saying there are firms who are trying to do this in a negative way. But again, when you create the means for people to do this, they're going to take advantage of
what's kind of the argument from the folks at Block One?
You know, I have not really looked at that issue closely, and I don't want to speculate on it because I'm not that active in the EOS community. But their response is, so in the Block One network, in the EOS network, Block One owns 10% of the tokens, and they actively participate in voting for block producers. And their stated intent is to vote for block producers that are underrepresented, whatever that means. But you know, an exchange like Huobi is also running its own block producer. Yeah, that's kind of problematic. And so there have been discussions around, you know, if people have really large stakes, can you somehow dilute their share of vote? This is why the US, by the way, has a representative democracy and has the House and the Senate, right? One is representative of the proportion of the population that lives in each state, and the other is two representatives per state, regardless of the state's population. So it's a way of balancing power in the governance system.
Let's talk about applications just for a moment. I'd love to hear kind of like what your thoughts are around sort of like other ways staking can be used in support of applications.
So I think right now the phase we're at, just being very realistic of where we are as a community, these protocols are just launching, right? So the Tezos network, the EOS network launched, you know, 8 months ago. The Tezos network not launched 8 months ago. There are new networks that are launching. Algorand's going to launch soon, and they have a different way of incentivizing participation in the network. So these networks are just starting to launch. These protocols, you know, are evolving. They're evolutionary. I think Cosmos, you know, in its first 3 weeks has already voted on 4 different proposals. There's a lot happening, and it's very active. And as we learn new things, people are designing new tools to help manage both the protocol and to build out the computational network that will support these protocols. And then once you have a robust network in place, I think then you see people starting to build applications. The challenge with applications right now is there is a competition among protocols for use cases, right? So everyone has kind of taken this approach of build it and they will come. But if they're not coming, how are you going to incentivize people to build on top of your protocol? And so this is where it starts to get interesting, because people start giving away tokens. People start giving away cash. People start incentivizing people to come to their network, their community, whatever, using these different incentives. The same way that a government might incentivize people to set up shop in their country using tax incentives, right?
Yeah, it's why you have a home in Alaska. So that sweet $1,000.
Exactly. I chose Wyoming, but I am still a New York resident, but I hope to one day soon move to Wyoming. But look, this is normal, this is natural, and I feel like we're still at the stage where these networks are in flux. The interesting question I always have is, will there be thousands of networks that have sufficient computational capacity to support applications, or will we see, you know, what we saw with ISPs, where they were highly localized, then became more global in nature, and formed the backbone of one network? And so, to me, there are some fundamental questions there that we are exploring. And I talked about this a lot last year with my idea around protocol M&A and how several protocols might merge to become one. And the fun part of all of this for me is, these are all ideas, and we get to live these experiments in real time. So
yeah, for sure. Which protocols do you think are most ripe for M&A?
No comment.
Oh, no, that would have been good. My colleague, Brittany, here at Blockstack was telling me you're a big sort of pronouncer of like VC being dead. I was wondering, like, do you have any view on how VC potentially gets involved in staking and what the evolution of that could look like if there is one?
Sure. Look, so last year, 2018, I spoke at a large tech event with Brittany's former colleague, Albert Wenger from USB, and I made this sweatshirt that had printed on the front, "Venture capital is dead."
How
and
dare you.
Look, we had a great laugh about it, but I do think venture is in an evolution, right? So historically, as a VC, you look at different companies building emerging technologies, and then you purchase equity in these companies and you help them grow and you help them scale. And at some point, when there's an exit event, whether it's an acquisition or an IPO, then you make lots of money and you share with all the people who've invested and so on and so forth. This is fundamentally changing with crypto networks. So we are starting to see many VCs getting involved in crypto networks by buying tokens. When you buy tokens, you don't have the same 10-year obligation. You're not waiting for an exit. So it fundamentally changes the dynamics of how VCs interact with their portfolio companies, and it changes the social contract, number one. Number two, I think one of the other fundamental changes we're seeing here, and you see this actually reflected with the decision Andreessen Horowitz made to become a registered investment advisor, as opposed to being a fund relying on the VC exemption from the SEC. And the reason why is they wanted to have greater flexibility to engage with their companies in different ways. And at the end of the day, if I look at the world of finance, where I come from, financial engineering has created all of the wealth we see in America. Yes, the backbone is technical innovation, but really what's been made possible in our markets has been a product of financial engineering. And crypto networks are rife for new types of financial engineering through the digitization of these investment products using smart contracts, through the existence of this new incentive called the token, and through these new representations of value that we're experimenting with. And so I think as a result, venture as an investment category is also changing, because there is now this new financing mechanism that isn't just exclusive to crypto networks anymore. People everywhere are looking for new ways to capitalize ideas. And the one thing, again, that we're not keeping in mind as we do this, people are trying to engage in financial alchemy. Yes. And at the end of the day, if the incentives are not properly aligned, if the incentives are not properly structured, it's not going to work, because alchemy is not feasible. You cannot transmute base metals into gold. Similarly, if you have a company that has no users and no fundamental business metrics, you cannot turn it into a multi-billion dollar company, although some have tried and some have succeeded at that temporary version of financial alchemy. But at the end of the day, there has to be something that substantiates value. And so I think this is kind of the tricky phase we're at, is do we just continue engaging in this pursuit of financial alchemy as a tool for people to, you know, make lots of money while making no real commitments? Or do we design incentives that incorporate the last 100 years of financial markets experience to build systems that align incentives? Again, I am not trying to take sides here. I am just trying to highlight that there is this fundamental tension. And people are not speaking about it. And in my view, if people are not speaking about it, it's because they don't want to. And there's probably a reason for that. And that is all I'll say on that topic.
Sure. I wanted to kind of double click into the last 100 years. Are there specific things that come to mind that you feel like could potentially be useful that people are not talking about?
I think there are a lot of exciting opportunities for me on the financial engineering side, on the incentive management side, on the capital management side that people aren't doing. So I come from the world of corporate finance, as I like to say it, on my podcast with my friend Jill, who's also a financier turned crypto person. And so I think one of the things we don't think about enough is incentives. Theory of the firm, why the corporate structure exists, how people manage capital, how you think about the opportunity cost of capital, how you think about equity versus debt versus tokens, how you think about managing the assets you have, whether it's intellectual property or something else, or it's tokens. You know, there are reasons that our world looks the way it does. It isn't because people weren't smart. It's because people have tried to design systems, entities, affiliations, incentives that allow a large number of people to participate in creating enterprise value and then realizing that enterprise value kind of collectively. And so to me, you know, many of the projects in 2017, 2018 that engaged in token sales, you know, really did not have an interest in building enterprise value. The day is, if no one is left holding these tokens, what is the incentive to work on the network? So there are some fundamental lessons there that I think we're not thinking about around incentives, but more and more people are starting to talk about it. And again, we're learning collectively.
Yeah, for sure. What in your mind is a project that's showing early signs of avoiding tragedy of the commons?
Oh, I mean, I think there are a lot of projects that are doing a good job with communication, transparency, and look, it is impossible to design something I think that is perfect at the outset. Most of these things are evolutionary, and there are a handful of projects that I think have done a good job evolving as they learn based on the type of activity they see. I think step one is you have to look at the data to really understand what's happening in these networks. And so I think, for example, Decred has done a good job. They introduced Politea last year. I got a good laugh out of it, imagining a decentralized treasury, but I've spent some time looking at the proposals on Politea, and I think, in fact, that's been a great way to bring transparency as to how an organization is spending their treasury capital. And we see now, for example, the Ethereum Foundation, who's taking kind of the opposite approach, is now getting a lot of questions and a lot of criticisms about its opacity in how it's spending its capital. And so I think, again, you know, there are these narratives that occur in crypto around the same time, and there are organizations, protocols, projects, communities that respond by creating new tools and new experiences and by bringing more transparency and reliability. And then there are others who respond with more opacity. I do have a lot of projects I'm concerned about who raised a lot of money, say, 18 months ago, 24 months ago, that we haven't heard from since then. And so that, you know, to me is, I just look at that and I don't know how that's going to work. There are other projects who I think have, you know, done things differently and been very transparent, sometimes to their own detriment, which is interesting. I certainly have tried to be very transparent in my dealings in the crypto community and have gotten criticism for it. But look, at the end of the day, this is a long process. We are at stage one or stage two of something that will take 20 to 30 years to be formalized and codified into science. And what I liken it to is like all of these things start life as pseudoscience, right? As alchemy. And alchemy was the basis for the foundation of modern chemistry, modern philosophy, and all of these branches of natural sciences. But it began as pseudoscience. And likewise, a lot of what's happening in token land today feels a bit like pseudoscience, but we're starting to see the emergence of new ways of conducting academically rigorous research and actually gathering empirical data to validate or invalidate the reality of some of these claims that people are making, and that will continue. But it takes time, so I try to be as optimistic as I can.
Right, and we only have a couple of minutes left. I was wondering, two things. Are there any folks that are sort of outside crypto land that would be uniquely qualified to help accelerate the experimentation with staking and governance and are not currently being put in play?
I do think there are a lot of people who are interested in it, and I've spoken to some of them at various academic institutions. But I do think, you know, there is a lot of research happening. And all of the academics who've wanted to join CryptoLand have plenty of opportunities too. I know plenty of projects are hiring. I've met a few economic consulting firms who are trying to design better blockchain economics and governance. But, you know, I would say there is there is a large body of entities, organizations out there who are participating. And it heartens me to see that organizations like the Human Rights Foundation, the EFF, Open Privacy Project, among others, are getting involved. So I don't know the answer to that question, but I would say, in my experience, the crypto community is very welcoming of anyone who would like to come and spend time on this with us.
No problem. Great. That's awesome. And then I guess just in closing, are there any resources, conferences, people that you'd recommend listeners kind of go to if they want to learn more about staking? And I guess we spoke a little bit about governance as well.
Yep. So I think in terms of staking and governance, there's a lot of great work that's coming from the protocols themselves. So any of the protocols deploying proof of stake, I think, do a great job sharing information. There is a new nonprofit we're working on for staking that hopes to aggregate a lot of this research from across different projects, different companies, different investors. I think there are a handful of investors that are doing a lot of writing about this topic. Myself, the team at Placeholder, is doing a lot of work on this, and some others. So I think there's a lot of great material available out there, and I think much of it is being shared by, being sort of popularized by many of the projects who are grappling with these very questions.
Great. Well, you know, I think you've been like a wealth of knowledge, and I'm really excited to share this with the community. Thank you so much for joining. These answers are really great, and I hope to have you back on again.
Well, looking forward to what Blockstack does with its governance, and very excited. As someone, I do have a stake in Blockstack. I own Stacks tokens, so I do want to disclose that. But very excited to see what you guys do, and hopefully welcome you to this group of people who are exploring governance and all of these myriad implications of these new mechanisms of reaching both technical and social consensus.
And yeah, it'll be a measured approach for sure. Thanks so much again, and I'll chat with you on the Twitter sphere.
This has been the Stacks Podcast. You can follow Meltem on Twitter at melt_dem. Patrick Stanley is available at Patrick W. Stanley. And I'm at Zach Valenti. If you like this episode, please consider leaving a rating or review for the show wherever you listen to podcasts. To learn more about building decentralized apps, please visit blockstack.org. The music in this episode is by Andrew Apple Pie. Check out andrewapplepie.com for more. Until next time. Thank you for listening.